Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. President Kiir apologizes to the nation in a way.
In the spirit of national unity, forgiveness, and dialogue, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me.
And a high-ranking UN human rights official warns South Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale war.
South Sudan stands on the brink of an all-out ethnic civil war. Wherever we visited, people told us the country would dissolve into another Rwanda-like situation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir asked the South Sudanese people to forgive him for mistakes he says he might have committed during a speech in Juba today. The president also ordered government forces to observe a ceasefire and create a conducive environment for communities to reconcile. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
A police band plays as President Kiir approaches the podium at Juba's National Legislative Assembly building, where he delivered his end-of-year address. During the speech, Mr. Kiir asked citizens for their forgiveness.
In the spirit of national unity, forgiveness, and dialogue, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me. I read this sentence again. I said, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me for any mistakes I might have committed. This is a spirit that our country needs, and we must act now. I pledge to all of you, fellow citizens, that the new year dawns on us. I will leave no stone unturned in the search for peace, reconciliation, and unity in our great country.
The president says the national dialogue should include people from all sectors of society as the country's three-year-long conflict drags on.
I strongly believe that the current situation in our country calls for a national dialogue. It calls for unity and an end to the cycle of violence and atrocities. National dialogue, in my view, is both a forum and process through which the people of South Sudan can gather to redefine the basis of their unity as it relates to nationhood, citizenship, and a sense of belonging.
President Kiir says a national dialogue will allow South Sudanese to openly discuss how the country should be structured and what the development priorities should be. He says the government will ensure the dialogue is credible, genuine, and open to all South Sudanese people, and that its outcome will be accepted by all and implemented.
To achieve this, I am throwing the full weight of your government behind it. But the government will not lead or control this process. The government shall be a stakeholder in the national dialogue. I strongly believe in South Sudanese-led process, and so we have identified our fellow citizens who are persons of consensus with the structure and integrity to steer this process.
President Kiir did not elaborate on who selected the persons of consensus and integrity, nor did he name the people steering the process. But Mr. Kiir insists it will involve grassroots consultations, regional peace conferences, and a national conference in Juba. Faith-based groups and local think tanks such as the Sud Institute, the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, and the Juba University Center for Peace and Development Studies are to be involved in the planning process, according to the president. Mr. Kiir said the government will guarantee the safety and freedom of all actors who participate in the national dialogue, including those out of the country who oppose his government.
I call upon those who are still carrying arms to stop destroying their own homes and their own country and join the process of national dialogue. I also call upon our national army and all the security organs to uphold their constitutional mandate to protect all the citizens and their property. I promise that no grievances will be left unaddressed in this process.
The president also warned against hate speech, saying his government will take serious measures against individuals who promote ethnic hatred and violence.
I also call upon those propagating hate speeches in the social media, international and local forums to stop tearing their country and communities apart. We are bound together as one people, one nation, and we cannot allow our political and social disappointments to destroy our country, our unity.
And President Kiir instructed South Sudanese people to, as he put it, stop any propaganda against the international community, especially the American people and the United Nations. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
South Africa says it is concerned over media reports that say former First Vice President Riek Machar is, quote, basically under house arrest. A Reuters report yesterday quoted an unnamed source as saying that Machar, who has been staying in the country since October, is under heavy restriction and surveillance. One unnamed source in the Reuters report is quoted as saying, if he wants to go to the toilet, he has to hand over his phone, and a guy stands outside the cubicle. End quote. The South African government is dismissing that report today in an emailed press release. In the statement issued by South Africa's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the government says it is taking care of Machar, given his profile. The emailed statement went on to say that South Africa, through its partnership with IGAD Plus, is committed to working with the government and the people of South Sudan in search of peace, stability, and development. The UN Human Rights Council warns that South Sudan's future is grim, and an uptick in violence will not only further jeopardize the country, but the region as a whole. In her address to the council in Geneva today, Yasmin Suka, one of the three members of the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, says more needs to be done to avert a full-scale civil war.
South Sudan stands on the brink of an all-out ethnic civil war, which quite frankly can destabilize the entire region. Wherever we visited, people told us the country would dissolve into another Rwanda-like situation.
South Sudan's more than 800% inflation rate is among the highest in the world, and the humanitarian crisis is only getting worse, according to Suka. Despite the humanitarian, political, and economic crisis, Suka notes that a regional protection force, which was supposed to act as a buffer of safety for civilians, has yet to be deployed.
We urge the immediate deployment of the 4,000-strong regional protection force for South Sudan. It's been a number of months since July when the regional protection force was first spoken about. It's December now, and it has not yet arrived.
At UN headquarters in New York yesterday, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon announced the appointment of the new UNMISS chief, who was expected to begin his duties in 2017. He replaces Margaret Loge, who finished her term at the end of last month. David Shearer is a member of parliament in New Zealand, where he has been in office since 2009. Shearer spent a large part of his career in the humanitarian field, serving for 3 years as the Secretary General's Deputy Special Representative, Resident Coordinator, and Humanitarian Coordinator in the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq. He also served as head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the occupied Palestinian territory, and as humanitarian coordinator in Lebanon, as well as senior humanitarian advisor to the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan. Shearer is expected to resign from parliament at the end of the month and begin as UNMISS chief at the start of the new year. Meanwhile, an exasperated chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court addressed the UN Security Council in New York yesterday about the ICC's inability to prosecute Sudan President Omar al-Bashir for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur. Fator Bensouda told the council in New York today that Mr. Bashir and other high-ranking Sudanese officials facing similar charges have traveled outside of Sudan for years with impunity and urged the council to take action.
As time passes, ICC fugitives continue to travel across the international borders unimpeded by the failure of Sudan, other states, including, I regret to say, some states' parties to enforce the court's arrest warrants. A further aggravating factor is this council's inaction. It is no surprise, then, that victims and witnesses of the office are slowly but surely losing faith in the process of international criminal justice in Darfur.
Bensouda notes that President Bashir has traveled freely around Africa on hundreds of occasions since being charged by the ICC.
According to my office's information, Mr. al-Bashir has crossed international borders on 131 occasions since March of 2009, and on 14 occasions to state parties, and on 117 occasions to non-state parties. His movements are traceable. The world knows where he is, where he travels to, often in advance from the media. There is ample opportunity for Mr. al-Bashir to be apprehended if the political will exists among states and indeed this council.
Bensouda says the ICC cannot do its work without the help of the UN Security Council and UN member states. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Blood donations are down in South Sudan. Find out where and why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the greatest lesson you have learned from a relationship or marriage?
The greatest lesson I've learned is to accept others based on who they are and not based on what you want them to be.
Human beings are not perfect. They can hurt you sometimes, but then you also need to forgive.
I've learned not to give too much and not to trust at all. Because I gave too much, I gave myself fully and I never reaped anything out of it.
It's that of trust. It's that of trust, because without trust, there is no way you can thrive on with a relationship.
In marriage, I have learned one thing, to be patient.
I cannot trust a woman 100%, you know. That is relationship. And I think I cannot cheat on my woman because she is my woman. So that is my experience.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Officials of South Sudan's National Blood Bank say cultural norms prevent many people from donating blood. They say many patients who need a blood transfusion often reject blood from donors they do not know personally, for fear it will be tainted. Michael Atit visited a blood donation center in Juba and has this report for VOA.
Health officials have set up a temporary blood donation center in Juba's Nyakron Market under a tent about 5 by 5 square meters. Under the tent sit two desks, a bed, two tables and a couple of chairs.
What about operation, like minor operation?
Never.
A potential donor speaks to a health worker at the first desk who weighs him and asks him few health-related questions. The potential donor walks to the second desk where another health worker asks him to fill out a form, then takes blood samples to test for HIV and other diseases. Duku Galen, a blood donor recruitment officer at the National Blood Bank, says many South Sudanese still have a negative attitudes about donating blood, including patients who urgently need a blood transfusion. Galen says even they sometimes reject blood unless they are certain the donor is a tribe mate.
Some people say, of course, their culture do not allow sharing of blood. You cannot give your blood to maybe share with different tribes. Or sometimes they believe like you may behave, one time behave like that person, the way he or she is acting.
Nurse Mary Gou Gordon, who works at the National Blood Bank Transmission Service in Juba, confirms that some patients who need blood transfusion are skeptical about the sources of blood they are about to receive. She says foreign nationals living or working in South Sudan are less squeamish about receiving blood transfusion.
I think in their country,
they know the goodness of donating blood. Like South Sudanese being a new culture, others is scared. Others could tell you, I don't know my blood is going for whom. Maybe it could be from ethnic group that I don't like.
Galan says the ongoing economic crisis prevents potential donors from giving blood because people say they are too hungry to give blood.
They feel like they are not able to donate simply because they don't have enough food. Like if they donate afterward, how will they retain or recover back their blood?
37-year-old blood donor Musa Bakute Francis hails from neighboring Central African Republic. Speaking in Arabic, Francis says this is the second time he has donated blood. Francis says he came here to donate blood to help sick people in the hospital, including those who might have gunshot wounds and are in desperate need of a blood transfusion. He says mothers who give birth also might need blood. Francis says by doing this, he believes he might receive many blessings from God. 27-year-old Wani Thomas John is a South Sudanese who came to the center to donate blood. This is John's second time donating blood. His first time was in 2013. Thomas says he donates blood because he believes life is about sharing, and in particular, it is about saving women's lives.
There are some women who have been pregnant, but they may not have blood. Because I know women are the people who can build a nation through the woman. That's why today we have been in the wall here. That's why I do respect the woman.
Contrary to popular belief in South Sudan, the National Blood Bank does not sell blood it receives from donors. Galen stressed the importance of donating blood in a place like South Sudan.
We prevent people from losing their lives as a result of lack of blood due to sickness, or due to accident, or maybe during operation, or even in women during labor, maybe it may happen. One may deliver, and in due course, also we lose a lot of blood. And if the woman under delivery is not helped, may lose her life.
The South Sudan National Blood Bank was established 2 years ago to help donors give blood to patients in hospitals. Galon says the blood bank supply is down due to high demand at the Juba Teaching Hospital and at the Kiada Military Hospital. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
And wow, thousands of people who fled violence are living inside the grounds of a cathedral with help from humanitarian organizations. Nearby, another 29,000 internally displaced people are living at a site to protect civilians, run by the UN. From WOW, Jill Craig reports, many are thankful for the help, but they really just want to go home.
It's called the St. Mary Help of Christians Cathedral, and right now it's helping more than an estimated 8,500 South Sudanese who have fled fighting around the town of WOW since violence erupted there in June. Francis Moga is the camp officer here.
The church is like a faith-based organization that also can provide like humanitarian assistance, and in times of trouble, you need to stand by your people.
But St. Mary's, or the Cathedral IDP Center, as it's now known, has become more than just a spiritual home for these internally displaced people, who have brought their families to live on the church grounds until they can return home. Sitting behind a sewing machine inside a small shelter with a tape measure around his neck, tailor Adam Itman Idris says he moved to the cathedral in July to flee violence. He says, I think this is more safe than if I go back to my area, where I have to listen to the gunshots and the night robbery every time. Helping these newcomers is an undertaking of almost biblical proportions. While the church lends its space, Moga explains that the World Food Program supplies food, Oxfam helps with water, IOM assists with health care, and UNHCR handles general protection. Just across town is a UN Protection of Civilians site, which hosts another 29,000 IDPs. Although many of them are thankful for the assistance, they say they'd rather be home. 66-year-old Bernard Kabas has been living at this Protection of Civilians site for 6 months now. He says that he witnessed killing, raping, and looting in June, which caused him to flee to this site.
Nobody wants to stay, but because the life there is not safe, that's why we are still here now.
IDPs have described how uniformed men and young Dinka attacked areas primarily inhabited by ethnic Fertit in the June clashes. Prior to these attacks, Western Bahr al-Ghazal had been spared much of the violence that had struck other parts of the country. The government has denied involvement by its soldiers, instead blaming the rebels. Security is stricter at the UN camp than the cathedral, but some church residents say they're getting help from a higher power.
The belief we have in faith, that we are Christian, we are praying every day. So this is how we are staying here without fearing anything that may happen to us.
Camp officials say they are hosting more than 3,600 IDPs at three other church locations around Wau. Despite the challenges, officials say they will continue doing so until it's safe for people to leave. Jill Craig, VOA News, Wau, South Sudan.
South Sudanese traditional leaders say they will employ traditional justice mechanisms to address legacies of conflict in South Sudan and promote reconciliation and sustainable peace across the country. The traditional leaders met in Juba last week for the third annual Rule of Law Forum for traditional leaders. Tito Justin has a story for VOA from Juba.
More than 30 traditional leaders from across the country came together in Juba to talk about traditional justice as a vehicle for peace and reconciliation in South Sudan. Martin Machek Malual, director of the local government board which communicates with chiefs across South Sudan on behalf of the government, says the traditional leaders passed nearly 20 resolutions, one of which urged the Transitional Government of National Unity and peace monitors to involve traditional leaders and elders in the country's peace process.
All is about peace. They have to do the reconciliation and peace and reconciliation. So they are to talk to some of the chiefs and other stakeholders so as to implement these resolutions.
James Duop Gatluak is one of the traditional leaders from Western Bay State's Fangak. Speaking in Arabic, Dope explains how he plans to promote peace among residents in his community once he returns home.
Issues like those who grab or steal other people's things, I will be able to know how I can bring such perpetrators to book so that people live in peace. This is what I got from this workshop. Number two, conflicts between neighbors and how I can be able to reconcile them using the knowledge I got from this workshop.
Dope also wants government officials to involve traditional leaders in resolving land disputes and urge the landlords to cooperate with the traditional leaders. The workshop was organized by the United Nations Development Program. Roland Cole, UNDP's chief technical advisor, says the UN agency is ready to support the traditional leaders.
We have been providing, you know, some resources in a number of situations, like organizing forums, like facilitating the quotas to meet, like ensuring that there's ascertainment of customary laws, which ensures that, you know, we are able to do some research as to what the norms of the cultures and the practices of the people. From that perspective, some resources has been put into the delivery of traditional justice by UNDP South Sudan.
Cole says the UNDP wants to increase peaceful conflict resolution among communities across the country. He says the government and its development partners should organize more workshops like this one for traditional leaders.
Essentially, the objective is to find ways of harmonizing both systems. And in so doing, we engage with various stakeholders, not just the judiciary and the Ministry of Justice, but also the traditional leaders themselves, so as to explore ways in the harmonization process.
The traditional leaders are calling for the legislature to consider the criminal jurisdiction of customer courts and to expand their jurisdiction so they are allowed to handle more complaints brought to the courts by citizens. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
We continue our panel discussion today on hate speech, moderated by John Tanza, host of South Sudan in Focus. Today, John speaks with four South Sudanese in the diaspora on the impact of tribalism on hate speech.
You have to choose your family or your own belief, especially when you're faced with these issues of labeling people, that sometimes you find it hard. Do you follow what your family is telling you, or you follow your belief?
You follow what is right.
And what is it that is right?
Of course you're educated enough. Of course you're exposed enough. Like, for instance, people like us who are here in the Western world, we are exposed a lot to the extent that we should be able to tell what is wrong. I mean, which statement is right and which statement is wrong, which statement to follow and which one is not to follow.
They will tell you you are becoming holier than thou. If you say that, they will say you are preaching.
I have heard them say that a lot, but you can always, like, convince them by coming down to earth. You just be normal, sit down with them.
You could see it. Yeah, I can see your point is very good, because we all need to encourage that, try to invite each other. We benefit one way or another from our integration. But yes, when you come and they say we have secrets or matters that need to be discussed, this is understandable. Even high-top meetings always have closed-door meetings, and we understand that. But when it's coming to the social, where different groups, different age are inside, we welcome. I think I can encourage that myself. That will promote the integration between us as South Sudanese. Yes.
Dennis, do you agree with that? I can see you are itching to speak.
Yeah, I strongly agree with cross kind of communication among different communities in South Sudan. I think it is very important for us that we need to communicate more rather than just having only a kind of a close communication like within the group. The more we integrate, the stronger we become. And now these days that it is only communities or countries that believe in diversity are countries that can progress. And we in South Sudan, we happen to be the luckiest, because we have a diverse society, and this is the recipe for development.
We heard from Irene from Minnesota, Dr. Juku Wakason, who is a medical doctor and head of the Western Bahr el Ghazal community in the United Kingdom, Dow Dut Juk, founder of the Dut Juk Youth Foundation, and Dennis Lisa, an accountant in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The four South Sudanese were sharing their views about how labels can fuel hate speech. Tomorrow, we talk about the role of social media in promoting hate speech. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Respect and Respond by Krembe. Listening to Krembe with the song Respect and Respond. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.